Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Lorenza Fontana about her book published by Cambridge University Press titled Recognition Politics, Indigenous Rights and Ethnic Conflict in the Andes, which is a really interesting book because it takes us to a set of conflicts that have been very much overlooked in the Andean region, that in some senses might be surprising because they often are coming in reaction to policies that seem to be improving things in terms of Indigenous rights. And yet there are some unexpected or unanticipated consequences and reactions. And generally, the picture is perhaps a lot more complex than we might assume, which is why investigating them, as Lorenza has done in the book, is so incredibly helpful. Lorenza, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit to our audience and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So my name is Lorenza Fontana. I am a professor of politics at the University of Torino in Italy and a visiting professor at the University of Glasgow in the UK. I am Italian, but I spent most of my academic career abroad between the UK, the US and Latin America. And I have just recently moved back to Italy, so all new experience for me. The book is the result of over 10 years of research and engagement with Latin American politics, particularly in the Andean region. This journey started with my PhD, where I focused on land conflicts in Bolivia. But at that point, I felt there was more to be said about the subject. And so I gathered some additional funding and see if and how my ideas and arguments about Bolivia would travel to other countries in the region. Particularly, I looked at Colombia and Peru. So the book really tells the story of this journey and also provides a theoretical framework to make sense of what I propose as a new kind of interethnic conflict, which is present across the three countries and beyond, which I call, as you said, the recognition conflict.
So I think that makes a very straightforward place to go next. What are recognition conflicts and why are they important?
So one of the main contributions of the book to the literature on recognition and ethnic and cultural rights is the identification of intercommunal conflicts, which I argue emerge as a result or as a consequence of the implementation of recognition rights. There is a lot of research on recognition reforms and on how they have had perhaps empowering effects, particularly for traditionally marginalized indigenous groups. But these positive effects have come with some unforeseen social costs, or this is what I argue in the book. So in contrast to what are the mainstream, more progressive interpretation of the politics of recognition, which argue that these politics offer more peaceful and inclusive arrangements for ethnically diverse societies, as many in Latin America and beyond, the argument of the book is really that these politics contain seeds of conflict. So while they improve, and I don't deny this, social inclusion, I think that under certain conditions, they increase social differentiation in cultural and socioeconomic terms. And perhaps they also expand the gaps between communities of rural poor, they reduce the incentives to cooperate and generate new types of social conflicts, which is this type of conflict that I called recognition conflict. So just to provide a definition of these conflicts, I define this as a pattern of behavior in which social groups consistently engage in contexts with each other over goods, services, power, social boundaries, or perhaps even leadership as part or as a consequence of the recognition of specific ethnic rights. The parties in competition often self-identify as members of distinct and bounded communities, which are divided along ethnic but also along class lines. And public authorities are important in this picture. But state involvement is not a condition for recognition conflicts to happen. I'm aware there is a high volume of disputes and that these have been very well studied in which groups, particularly ethnic groups, claim different forms of legal and social recognition by states. But these are excluded from my definition. So these are more vertical conflicts where there is a clear dimension of imbalance of power. What I'm focusing in the book is the horizontal dimension of recognition claims, which are those situations in which the main dispute occurs between two or even more social groups or communities in conflict with each other. So the horizontal dynamic is really crucial in my discussion, and this is something that has been very poorly addressed in the literature so far, I think.
It's in fact the literature I'd love to ask you to tell us a little bit more about, especially given what you've just described. Can you tell us more about the generations of scholarship on recognition, on ethnic mobilization in Latin America that you're contributing to and kind of where you hope to push the research agenda?
Yes, in the book, I propose a classification of the scholarship on recognition and ethnic mobilization, particularly in Latin America, and I divide this into three main generations. So the first generation of research considered ethnicity as relatively marginal for social action. And what was important at the time was the study of ethnic groups within a broader approach to the rural question, and particularly through class lenses. So what was important was this dimension of class. This reflected, at least in part, the prominence of PESA movements across Latin America, particularly between the 50s and the 70s. But at some point, those movements went through a crisis. And that was the moment in which we see the emergence of new social actors with strong ethnic associations. And this happened throughout the 80s. So in this time, the attention of scholars, and especially anthropologists, became more explicitly focused on the ethnic question. And in many cases, this was in a sympathetic way, if not even militant, to support cultural and identity-based claims and forms of organizations. So this is what I call the second generation of scholarships on recognition, this attention to identity-based movements and even this more political engagement with activism. The third generation developed with a period of recognition reforms that started in the early 90s. And this was dominated particularly by political scientists, when they became very interested in questions around when and under what conditions indigenous movements were created, and particularly how their claims related to broader democratic arrangements. And potentially this was signaling a turn towards what some scholars called post-liberalism. So the focus on recognition as either a normative principle to guide institutional reforms or as a framework for claim making means that most academic work has so far concentrated on the period preceding recognition. And this is understandable if you think about it. We can think about historical indigenous mobilizations as social uprising that started in the 90s, like the Zapatista Rebellion in Mexico, or the March for Dignity and Territory in Bolivia in the 90s. These were paradigmatic turning points in the entire Latin American political scenario. So in a way, it's understandable why recognition in the sense of the focus on reform and claims became central in scholarly work. Yet recognition, I argue in the book, is not the end of the story, but rather the beginning of a different and perhaps less epic story. And the book is setting the agenda for this story about where the center is post-recognition rather than recognition. So what comes after recognition has been granted? And this is what I call the fourth generation of research on recognition, which exactly shifts the focus to post-recognition and is just starting now to emerge.
So One of the things obviously emerging from that is, of course, your work. So can you introduce us then, given that genealogy, to your framework for analysis and the typology you've created of recognition conflicts?
So here things can get a bit technical, so bear with me. But in brief, I try to identify two sets of mechanisms that underpin different types of recognition conflicts. And these mechanisms have to do with the features of the norm and the features of social communities. So the first set of mechanisms focuses on the link between recognition reform and conflict. So I argue here that recognition reforms open new window of political opportunities, to use a very common term in political science, that people may use to trigger social action. So this concept is particularly useful in illuminating the importance of external condition to explain why and when a conflict occur. In particular, with regard to this, I introduce a distinction between two different elements that coexist in most recognition reforms. And this is to untangle the different ways in which mechanisms embedded in these reforms can increase social tensions. So I argue that recognition norms work as triggers of recognition conflicts in two different ways, through what I call means of recognition and means of redistribution. So these in particular are provisions of recognition norms that set up different actions or systems through which recognition can be achieved. So the means of recognition concept describes all those tools that mobilize symbolic resources. So these are conceptual distinctions, classification, interpretation strategies, cultural traditions, and these create and in a way institutionalize social differences on ethnic or cultural grounds. So means of recognition are those provisions that clearly allow to differentiate between one group and the rest of society based on these ethnic and cultural criteria. One of the most important ways in which these means of recognition function is through the definition of the subject of recognition. So who is entitled to recognition? This is a very important question that comes up in the book multiple times. And just to clarify this, it would perhaps be helpful to give some examples of these means of recognition through this subject mechanism. And examples are, for example, the inclusion of questions on ethnic belonging in national censuses, or the definition of criteria and institutional mechanism to identify and classify ethnic groups within laws and constitutions. So all those mechanisms to create new subjects in the law, particularly in institutions, are the means of recognition. The other major way through which norms of recognition impact the politicization of ethnic identities is through what I call means of redistribution. This refers to the provision through which recognition norms institutionalize the allocation of certain resources on an ethnic basis. So in this sense, the redistributive component becomes central in this kind of mechanisms, and particularly land became the key concept and understood as the sine qua non of these kind of rights, particularly ethnic rights and particularly the rights of indigenous peoples. So in many Latin American countries, the influential debate about indigenous rights has been central in shaping agrarian reform and national land policies. So land became one of the most conflictive issues in this context, but it's not the only one. It's not the only means of redistribution of recognition reforms. There are other examples, for example, special taxation regimes for ethnic groups, or direct transfer of public resources to ethnic or cultural communities. So these are the first two mechanisms related to the norm. So let's now look at the second set of mechanisms that underpin recognition conflicts. And these are related to some key characteristics of social communities impacted by recognition reforms. So identify two of these characteristics of social communities, and I argue that these characteristics can increase the likelihood of conflict among these communities. Well, one is social heterogeneity, and the other one is resource scarcity. So these are, in a way, rather obvious things we might consider when thinking about conflict and recognition. So social heterogeneity is when a community gathers many different groups, or even at least two different groups and collective identities, which represents different values, beliefs, and which in certain cases even follow different systems of local governance. But these communities still live side by side and share the same physical environment in a highly interactive mode of social organization. So this is a sort of like a spectrum of how heterogeneous a community can be. A resource scarcity is the measure of resources available to local communities, in this case understood as a function of the community and not of the environment, in the sense that often the environment can be very rich, but communities don't have access to those resources necessary. So based on these four mechanisms and characteristics of the norm and of the social communities, I propose a typology of recognition conflicts, which comes exactly from this interaction. And this exercise, I think, is useful to understand, or, you know, try to come up with a typology where different characteristics of these conflicts can be associated. And this can also help us explain a little bit why these conflicts are happening and what is behind, what is driving them. And this can have different, slightly different explanations. But I just want to be clear that this typology does not imply any rigid boundaries between the mechanisms that operate in each of these four scenarios. But these boundaries are, have, you know, they, we need to understand them as fluid, as most conflict actually in practice involve a combination of different norm mechanisms or social community characteristics. So these, in a way, are ideal types of conflict.
Sorry, please continue.
No, if you want, I can just briefly describe the fourth type. So my typology, the fourth type of conflict, which are participation conflicts, which are conflicts over definition of inclusion and exclusion in resource scarce contexts. The social reproduction conflicts are the distributive conflicts, and they result from the interaction between norms with highly redistributive potential and an endemic lack of resources experienced by communities. Then there are demographic conflicts, which are conflicts over redistributive assets and particularly land, in contexts where increased social heterogeneity is the result of demographic changes in these communities. And finally, access conflicts, which are conflicts over recognition policies focused on language and cultural rights, so with weak redistributive impact, and affirmative action measures in, again, socially heterogeneous communities. So these are the four typologies that result from this, from crossing these four mechanisms.
No, that's very helpful. So thank you for taking us through all of that. And I particularly take the point that, obviously, as you said, these are ideal types, right? The real world is not quite as neat as a typology might make it seem, which is, of course, why it's so helpful that you then apply this in the real world. So going back to your initial, something you mentioned right at the beginning, that kind of a lot of the research started in Bolivia and then extended, can you tell us a bit about kind of why Bolivia and then why you brought in Peru and Colombia as well as your case studies?
Yes, so the main reason why the Andes is a good, interesting place to study recognition is that these countries are world leading in the implementation of recognition reforms. So all the Andean countries incorporated the ILO Convention 169, which is the only binding convention on the rights of indigenous peoples within their constitutional frameworks. And also they have been implementing institutional and policy reforms that in a way give concrete relevance to this international norm. So it trickled down in their national frameworks. And also these societies have engaged in public debates on ethnic diversity, social inclusions, which have shaped in different ways innovative proposals for new models of citizenship in these countries. So they have overall similar policies across these three countries, which is good for me because these predicts, in a way, or helps me predict the fact that similar mechanisms are at work. And so I can trace these across different contexts, making sure that they are not linked to a particular legal framework. So in terms of my research, that was very valuable to have these similarities of recognition reforms across the three countries. But also these countries diverge significantly if we consider other contextual and historical features, and in particular their economies, their demographies, their political traditions and experience of political violence, for example. I won't go here in detail, but this is all discussed in the book. But the sense of these is that these differences are equally important in my framework, as they allow us to situate the implementation of recognition reforms within different political and economic contexts. So this variation contributes to strengthen my hypothesis of a link between recognition reforms and the emergence of similar patterns of social conflict and intergroup competition, which is what I focus in the book and what I was seeking when I did my fieldwork across these three countries.
Mm. No, that then makes a lot of sense as a comparison. Before we get into some of the things you found, can you give us an example of different ways in which these countries have implemented recognition reforms?
Yes, so there are many different examples here, but I think one of the most interesting, which is also discussed in the book, relates to national debates around the definition of the collective subject that should be granted access to one particular recognition measure, which is called free, prior, and informed consent. So this is a new participatory mechanism for development and resource governance targeting ethnic communities and indigenous groups. So the mechanism is included in the convention, the 169 convention that I already mentioned. And the goal of this mechanism is to achieve more effective bottom-up participation, particularly by establishing the obligation for the state and for private entities to consult or obtain the consent of indigenous peoples before engaging in large development projects and even legal reforms that in some way would affect them. So the interest in, FPIC, as this measure is known for the acronym, it's not entirely new. It dates back to the 80s, but the interest in this norm is quite recent and has been growing, particularly in the framework of new political economic models that are increasingly reliant on commodity exploitation across the region. And again, the Andean region has been pioneering the implementation of this mechanism worldwide. So here is where we find the most advanced legislation and institutionalization of FPIC if compared to other countries across the world. But these advances have led to a number of tensions, in particular on the definition of the collective subject, again, to come back to that topic of the collective subject that should be granted the right to FPIC. And actually, Bolivia, Colombia, and Peru, they came up with quite different answers to this question of the subject. So Bolivia has adopted a more, what I call a maximalist strategy where all is based on self-identification. So what the community, how the community define themselves and identify, whether with ethnic or non-ethnic identities. And this will define whether they have access or not to this right. Colombia tend to lean towards the opposite edge of the spectrum. So they adopt a rather minimalist approach. And in this approach, by definition, peasants remain excluded from this framework. And finally, Peru is sort of a middle case where the drawing of these identity boundaries is highly bureaucratic and privileges objective criteria over self-identification. So it's a result of this analysis and assessment for each community of whether they have or not ethnic characteristics. So this seems like a technical issue, but in practice, the implications are huge in terms of inclusion and exclusion of considerable parts of the rural population from this key mechanism to control resources and laws that impact them. So in practice, in these different countries, millions of people are either included or excluded from the right to FPIC, depending on what kind of definition of subject is adopted by these countries.
Mm. No, that's a very good example to show both the similarities and the differences. Is this then the idea of kind of who counts and who doesn't? Is this the biggest or the most common example of where we see recognition conflicts? Or is there another example you'd like to take us through in terms of examples of kind of what these tensions then escalate into?
Yes, I can. I would like to share some examples of some very local examples. So this FPIC mechanism is still happening at the national level. But when you go to local communities and even to very remote places, you see in very concrete ways how the implementation of recognition politics is affecting the relationship, the intercommunal relationships, and sometimes even relationships within the very same communities and even within families. So the case I want to mention is the first one I worked on, which is in Bolivia, in a municipality called Apollo, in the north of the country, a very, very remote region where I traveled back in 2010. And at the time, the community was still experiencing a high degree of conflict. And the conflict was coming mainly from the creation of a new organization called Indigenous Council of the Leko People, which was in a way competing with the old local organization, which was a peasant union, the Peasant Federation of the Franzamayo province. So the conflict originated in the mid-90s, where a group of leaders from the peasant organization decided to create a new organization inspired by this Leko culture and identity. So Lekos were one of the dominant ethnic groups in this region during the 16th and the 17th centuries, alongside with other ethnic groups. But following colonization by the Inca first and then by the Spanish, the Leko mixed with populations of different cultural and ethnic origins, and really few traces of this culture remain in the local culture in terms of language and traditions. So in 1999, this Leko organization put forward an official demand to title a quite substantial part of land that belonged to the local communities. So put forward this demand to the state and also the demand to be recognized as an indigenous people, which they obtained quite quickly. So in 2006 is when the National Institute of Agrarian Reform issued the first title for the Leko people. And this is really what triggered the most violent phase of the conflict with the peasant organization, where there was occupation of roots and even of the core of the local or a national park that is very important in Bolivia and is within this municipality. There were multiple attempts of negotiations led by the government, which were not really successful, and the whole clearing process of property titles in the region was sort of stuck because of this conflict. The interesting thing about this conflict is when I traveled there and I did a lot of interviews with local people, there was really this feeling of quite entrenched difference between the two groups. And these occurred even within the same families, where some people identified as indigenous and some people identified as peasants. So this was not really driven by any long-term belonging to one particular group or identity, but it was all very recent, you know, happened in the past 3 or 4 years. And yet the discourse was very strong. And, you know, one of the things that was most interesting to me was the way in which, for example, indigenous leaders were speaking about their identity as the true one, the most authentic one, and in a way claiming that the peasants were not acknowledging that they also belong to an indigenous people. So they had a sort of false consciousness, to use a Marxist expression. And on the other side, the peasants, they thought that there were a lot of inconsistencies in the way in which this new indigenous identity was created. And also they used repeatedly the word fake to describe the Leko identity. So for them, this identity was fake. It was not legitimate, and the only true identity was the peasant and even the Quechua identity. So again, referring to an ethnic identity, but a different one that was the real one in the region. So very strong arguments that were not only about land access, but were really about building and self-identifying with these new identities. And that was really eye-opening for me in the way in which identities are built and they become relevant for fights over resources at the same time.
Mm. No, it's a very interesting example. So thank you for taking us through that one. You mentioned earlier that obviously one of the differences in how the three countries implement recognition reforms is, I mean, due to many factors, one of which is, of course, also differences in demographics and also ways in which demographics are changing. Can you talk about how recognition frameworks, the extent to which they've been able to adapt to demographic challenges or pressures?
Yes, so changes in local demographics are common across the region. And they have generally introduced new challenges for the coexistence of different social groups, particularly in this post-recognition phase I focused on. These changes are generally rooted in both exogenous and endogenous factors. So exogenous are situations linked to migration, mostly, and migration in Latin America, although we all often focus on international migration, so migration from Latin America to the US or to Europe. There is a whole other dimension of migration, which is domestic, and it's often occurs not only from rural to urban areas, but also from urban to rural areas, or between two rural areas. So rural migrants looking for land mostly. So this is one of the main drivers of rural migration in Latin America, and particularly in these countries. And the endogenous factors, the main one is the increasing population rates, which is also documented and is happening in most indigenous communities across these countries. So as I described before, over the last three decades, this recognition framework has offered what we can consider some tactical tools with which indigenous communities can confront different challenges, including demographic challenges, which are related to either the arrival of new migrants or this population growth I was describing. One of the key strategies here has been the use of ancestral ties to territory as a requirement for cultural survival, which has been mentioned to effectively win claims for land and you know, land tenures and land deeds. So this strategy, however, which has been put in practice by many communities, has led to the strengthening of social boundaries and in a way opened new conflicts across communities which were coexisting peacefully until that point. So the concept of ancestrality became very important. But this concept and these old sets of tools related to ancestral ties to land was only available to those indigenous peoples and communities that didn't move, that stayed at least for a few decades in the place they were before and they were perceived to be from. So there is a sort of assumption of spatial stasis in the recognition framework, and particularly even in international human rights law. But we have to consider that displacement, mobility, migration of indigenous populations is very common across different historical phases and across different countries. You know, it's very hard to identify where a given group comes from, actually. Some groups, they keep the deeds from the colonial time, but this is very rare. But most groups lost any trace of documents of where their land was before colonization. And they were even forced often to move for different reasons. So the not recognition of the importance of migration and the effects, the consequences for these groups, it's really problematic in the context of recognition politics. These migrants are often confronted with competition over ethnic authenticity, as I said. Migrants abandon ethnicity as the primary source of individual and collective self-identification, often, and are sometimes adopting new identities, for example, the one of colonos. So even when migrants retain some link to their ethnic identities, and even when they come from regions that are populated by indigenous groups, as it is often the case with migrants from the Andean highlands to the lowlands, they often choose not to retain that cultural dimension of their identities and to shift to other identities. The problem here is the identity of colonos, for example, and the use of this term colono as the person that is occupying and migrating to different lands. As you can imagine, for all the connotation of colonization and post-colonial movements, the word colono is associated with allegedly greedy and self-centered attitudes, and it's generally perceived as very derogatory. So in general, we can say that the recognition framework is often unable to account for this complexity of this key human condition that is the mobility and migration, and that in turn this is accentuating boundaries which did not exist before, and they are not strongly associated with particular identities. So even people that could retain ethnic identities, when they move, they lose both their identity, but they lose also the rights associated with those very identities. And this has all sorts of consequences in terms of stigmatization and discrimination of some groups that are seen as those moving and occupying land that is not their ancestral land.
Mm. No, that's definitely a key point about the recognition frameworks. And I think we'll come back to kind of your overall perspective on them. But before we get there, I wanted to ask specifically about educational policies and the ways in which they've created or entrenched intergroup competition.
Yeah, so one of the chapters of the book focuses on education policies and what I call access conflicts. So in my topology, to come back to that framework. So I think it would be helpful if I give a couple of examples of how education policies can fuel this kind of intergroup competition. One example is from Colombia, from a region called INSA municipality in Western Cauca, a region that was really heavily affected by the conflict for many decades. So in this region, local indigenous communities have been coexisting and sharing their territories with migrants from other regions, peasant migrants, and these migrants have been mostly displaced by the conflict from more populated valleys. So the conflict in this area started with a decree that was issued by the Cauca's Education Secretariat, so by the local or the departmental administration. And in this decree, they listed a number of schools across the department that would benefit from a special type of education called educación propia, so the sort of indigenous education. And this would be run autonomously by indigenous administrations. So this area was entitled to create one of these schools, but the problem was that these peasant populations that were settled there for many decades did not agree to send their children to these indigenous school because they felt that was not representing their culture, their values, and they felt also that their children would be discriminated or lose opportunities when they were then looking for jobs outside these communities. So this really triggered a very intense conflict between these two parts of the local village, to the point that the peasants, the school was occupied by the indigenous dwellers for many years. And so the peasants had to organize and create schools in private houses where teachers would attend the peasant children. And it really was very difficult to find an agreement because there was the peasants were pushing for the idea of a two-school solution, so to have two different schools. But indigenous leaders were really resisting this, claiming that would be discriminatory with respect to their right to have their own education and to have that as part of the old culture of the local area. So this is one example of how, you know, the implementation of special culturally sensitive education systems could trigger conflict. And the other example is from Peru, from a region called Pangoa. This is also a region affected by the Peruvian conflict and still affected by a lot of drug trafficking and a lot of poverty as well. So another very remote region. And here the problem was with the implementation of an affirmative action measure that would allow indigenous children to access some scholarships to go to university. So the criteria that the government gave to allocate these scholarships were based on the fact that the children obtained a certificate of belonging to an ethnic community by their communal leaders, which were fine until some migrant Quechua parents started to ask for their children to be also allocated some of the scholarships. So Quechua is an indigenous group that usually inhabits the highlands of Peru, but many of these Quechua groups have migrated to the lowlands, like this case where Pangoa is, so to the forest, to more fertile areas in search for land. So again, to go back to the point I was making before about migration, the fact of having migrated prevented them from accessing some scholarships that were designed to be used by indigenous children. So they lost their identity and their rights, and they really were strongly resisting this understanding of allocation of scholarships and ethnic rights by the Peruvian government. But there were, at the time when I was doing my fieldwork, which was 2015, there was no evidence that the government would be ready to listen to their claims. And in support of these claims, they also started to dress again with the typical dresses from the highlands, to speak Quechua to their children, so to try to constitute what they called the Quechua from the jungle, instead of the Quechua from the highlands. So to constitute themselves as an ethnic group from this other region. But again, this triggered a lot of tension with local inhabitants and feelings of resentment for the fact of being excluded from access to a scholarship that in a way was designed to help children coming from remote areas and perhaps that have been didn't have access to a very good education system, which in a way was also the condition of the Quechua's living in the same areas and going to the same schools as other indigenous or local indigenous children.
Mm. So in that example, and of course, in multiple others through the course of this interview, you've demonstrated a number of ways in which you're finding suggests that these recognition reforms have quite a lot of problems sort of embedded in them or hadn't thought through some of the consequences. Do you want to kind of speak on a big picture, broader level about your critique of recognition reforms?
Yes, so I think this is a very good question and an important point. What I want to clarify first is that the book does not argue against the politics of recognition per se. And it is not the intention or my intention to provide sorts of ammunitions to the enemies or those that are opposing recognition, particularly those states that are still very reluctant to engage in the fight against exclusion and discrimination of ethnic minorities, which is a very real and dramatic reality in many of these different communities. The book, however, does challenge this dominant narrative about the effects of recognition in terms of inclusion and conflict mitigation. So in a way, it portrays a more nuanced picture of recognition outcomes. And this is by exploring these links between the global, the national, and the local politics. So often recognition is mentioned in this also as a tool for conflict mitigation because it would provide sort of compensatory measures for discriminated, traditionally discriminated and marginalized communities. But what I show in the book is that this is not always the case. And there are in particular some trade-offs that we need to consider between strengthening cultural and ethnic rights and increasing intergroup competition and socioeconomic differentiation. So these, I think, should be really acknowledged and also incorporated both in the theory of recognition and within both international and domestic policymaking on recognition. What I mentioned at the end of the book is this image that I'm very attached to, that is the idea of the shadow of recognition. So we need to look at what is happening after recognition is granted, but what is also happening in the shadow of recognition in order to grasp a more balanced understanding of these complex relationships between diversity and equality.
Hmm. Can you tell us in a bit more detail about the implications in theory and in policy of these findings?
So the book argues for the need to closely examine recognition theories and also politics, but in light of social facts. So this is what I'm trying to do, to gather empirical data to actually contribute to understand better how recognition works from a policy and theoretical perspectives. So the book has the ambition to make both theoretical and policy contributions. In terms of the theory, the book argues for a broader definition of recognition that goes beyond ethnic identity. So what I say is that more than a claim proper only to ethnic minorities, recognition can be understood rather as a necessary attribute for each and every collective actor. This is something that already Anna Arendt was saying very strongly. The fact that identity is not so much a substance as a requirement. And the requirement is of knowing and being able to define who we are dealing with. So recognition operates by selecting those identities that enable the establishment of these differentiated social landscapes and to allow us to identify the other, and with that operation also to identify who we are. So I think it would be more appropriate to talk about recognition needs for each and every individual and also collective actor, and to understand recognition as a general form of identity which includes a plurality of elements, not just ethnicity, and also that is compatible with strategies and power dynamics. So in a way, every individual and every collective actor has a need for recognition. So in a way, this is an operation of separating recognition from ethnic and cultural features. And in terms of policy, I point out the need for new thinking around the effects of recognition and this chain of actions and reactions that is triggered by recognition reforms. And I think this is particularly important when it comes to the local governance of recognition. Sometimes the outcome of policymaking are uncertain, but has been over 30 years from the implementation of recognition reform. So I do think it is time that we look closely at both the broader implications and the more localized impact. I think that recognition conflicts offer a sort of window to look into a number of problematic issues around recognition. But I also think that most of these issues can be prevented or moderated in different ways. And I propose some of these strategies in the conclusions of the book. One of them can be a more cautious design and implementation of recognition reforms. And some strategies that could be considered to mitigate what I call the seeds of conflict that are inherent in this recognition reform. So the most obvious one of these can be the evaluation. So how evaluation of policies is undertaken. And I suggest that the focus of evaluation is not only with respect to those groups that directly benefit from recognition, but to include also evaluation of the broader social community. So also those groups that coexist with ethnic communities but are not part of them. And this might help us understand if some successful outcomes from one group may result in negative effects for other groups, or if there is a deterioration of the overall situation, which was peaceful before. But even before getting to the evaluation, I think that we can think about other strategies to prevent conflictive outcomes. One of them could be through compensatory measures to groups that we expect to be negatively affected by the implementation of recognition reforms. And this compensation doesn't need to be monetary necessary. These measures can also aim at expanding and consolidating community rights, for example, and should definitely try to address the distributive claims of those communities. For example, we can think that while we grant land titles to indigenous peoples, which is a totally and definitely fair thing to do, we could offer peasant communities resources or technical expertise to be able also to secure land tenure in order to prevent this feeling of resentment and this horizontal conflicts I described. So definitely we need to address broader issues of inequality as a condition to ensure that recognition is implemented in a less conflictive way. And I think also, you know, in a more conceptual way, this can be described as mechanisms that are oriented towards the mutual construction of inclusion rather than exclusions. So in other words, it's not that really recognition should be curtailed or eliminated, as I said before, but rather it's a matter of perhaps leveling up the field of recognition so that more groups can access it, and also strengthening this horizontal cooperation rather than fueling conflict.
Very helpful detail there. So thank you for adding that both on the theoretical, the policy, but also finishing off with the conceptual as well. As you've mentioned throughout this, this is obviously a book and a project that you've been working on for quite some time to go into all of this detail. It is, however, out in the world now. The book is available. Is there anything you're currently working on or looking to work on next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic that you'd like to highlight for us?
Yeah, so it feels, I must say, it feels very good to see the book out there. it took many years. And during this time, I also had two children. And sometimes I think of the book as the third one. So, yeah, it's definitely a great achievement for me to see the book out. But at the same time, this is one of the moments where you realize you also want to focus on other things. So in most recent years, the last really 2-3 years have been shifting my attention to another field of study, which is actually, it sounds like pretty different, but it is related somehow, which are the politics of wildfires. So I have been studying the relationship between wildfires and social conflict in Bolivia through a project called Playing with Wildfire. And if you're interested, there is a website with a lot of images and videos we produce from this work. And I am now leading, I just started a new project, which is a big one, which will go on for 5 years, with funding from the European Commission, which is called FirePol, the Politics of Wildfires. And it is focusing on comparative politics of wildfires across many different countries in the global south. And the idea is really to understand here politics in a broad sense as norms and institutions, but also as other dynamics that can interfere with the way in which wildfires happen in different countries through, for example, corruption or social activism or cultural and dimensions of inequality in local communities. So there is a dimension both of policy analysis, but also a big dimension about social justice and what, and, you know, trying to understand the multiple dimensions that wildfires have in communities of the global south.
All right. Well, that sounds fascinating. Congratulations for getting the funding to do all of that. And best of luck with the project. And of course, while you're working on it, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Recognition Politics, Indigenous Rights and Ethnic Conflict in the Andes, published by Cambridge University Press. Lorenza, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. It was my pleasure.